Brad asked MC to set up a brief get-together with Kossoff to obtain his okay for going into the village. Instead, Kossoff convened a formal meeting of the full executive committee, all 12 department heads. "Show yourself to them so soon?" Kossoff asked from the head of the conference table. Even in the communicator's small screen, Brad could see the negative frown on his bearded face. Sitting cross-legged on the inflated floor of his tent, Brad started to reply. "I don't think I can learn much more about," Kossoff interrupted. "The schedule calls for a minimum of 2 weeks of observation before making physical contact with the aliens. Isn't that right, Dr. Littlejohn?" The display screen's view enlarged to show the entire conference table. The people sitting around it looked so small that it was difficult for Brad to make out their faces, but Littlejohn's dark, heavy brown features were unmistakable. "The schedule has some flexibility in it," the anthropologist began. Kossoff leaned forward in his chair, no mistaking the frown he wore. "Making actual physical contact with the aliens is the most delicate part of our mission, and the most important. We mustn't let impatience wreck our work." Brad asked, "So what am I supposed to do? Sit here and watch them from afar for another 10 days? "Another few days at least," Kossoff replied. "What's the point of that?" argued Brad. "What am I going to see that I haven't seen already?" "That's a primitive culture we're looking at. They work, eat, and sleep, day in and day out." Elizabeth Chang, head of the philology department, spoke up. In her low, smoky voice, she pointed out, "Every day you spend observing the aliens from afar, our linguistics program decodes more of their language. It is very difficult and very slow, but we are making progress. Do you not think it best to wait upon showing yourself to them until we have a fuller grasp of their language?" Kossoff nodded vigorously. Brad asked, "How long do you think it would take?" Chang's doll-like face eased into a gentle smile. "How far is up?" "We can't wait forever," Brad said. "Not forever, but perhaps a few more weeks," Chang replied. Quentin Abbott raised a hand. Without waiting for Kossoff to recognize him, the astronomer pointed out, "We do face a time limit, you know. The planet's conjunction with Beta is coming in 4 months. We shall have to move this ship to an orbit around Alpha before then. I should imagine you'll want to make contact before all that?" Kossoff waved a hand in the air. "Another week or two shouldn't make much difference." Abbott's brows rose toward his scalp. "Really?" Brad insisted. "I can make contact with them tomorrow morning." "And be their dinner tomorrow night," Kossoff muttered. Littlejohn said, "There's another element to consider. If Brad makes contact with them, and then the conjunction hits the planet with enormous storms and other ecological catastrophes, mightn't the aliens blame Brad for the disaster?" There was a moment of silence. Then comments came from around the table. "I hadn't thought of that. I suppose it's possible. They might think McDaniels is a witch. It might be better to wait until after the conjunction." Brad watched as they talked. Each person at the conference table had an opinion, or at least wanted to be heard. Finally, he said to them, "Well, instead of sitting around discussing the problem, you need to make a decision." Kossoff nodded. "You're right. Elizabeth, we'll give you and your people another 10 days to extend your understanding of the Gamma's language. Brad, you'll continue to observe them at a distance for 10 days. No contact until then. But the possibility that they'll blame McDaniels for the conjunction storms?" With a shake of his head, Kossoff answered, "They've been through conjunctions before. Even if it's happened before any of the living Gamans were born, they must have an oral history about it." Chang nodded daintily. "They do talk about a bad time, an evil time that brings death." "You see? 10 more days, and then McDaniels makes contact." Brad felt as if he'd been neatly maneuvered into waiting 10 days. Then he looked at Kossoff, who was smiling satisfiedly, and Brad felt frustration rising in him. Frustration and anger. Smoldering as he sat in his tent, Brad waited impatiently for the meeting to break up, then asked MC to connect him with Littlejohn on the anthropologist's personal channel. "Nobody listens in on personal calls, do they?" he asked the master computer. "No one but me," MC replied, "and I am programmed to respect an individual's privacy unless some matter of danger to the mission is involved." "Good. Put me through to Littlejohn, then," Brad almost added, "please. but new MC didn't need human politeness. The anthropologist was in his kitchen, just reaching out for a steaming cup of tea. "I thought you might call," Little John said, heading for the recliner in the sitting room. Still squatting on the floor of his tent, Brad blurted, "Kossoff is wasting valuable time." Little John stretched out on his recliner, his teacup still in his hand. With a sad little smile, he replied, "He doesn't see it that way. I don't understand why he wants me to spend another 10 days repeating what I've already done. I'm ready to make contact with these people, but he's not. Why not? Because you are?" Brad blinked with puzzlement. "What?" "He wants to make certain that you and everyone else knows who's in charge. It's a simple matter of two alpha males competing for leadership of the pack. I'm not competing with Kossoff, aren't you?" "No." With a slight shake of his head, Little John said, "Well, he thinks you are, and that's what matters. He feels he has to show you and everyone else that he makes the decisions and the rest of us follow his lead. That includes you." "That's crazy," Brad said. "He doesn't see it that way. I don't think he even realizes what he's doing. But the most important thing to him is to maintain his position as leader. That means he has to make sure that you do what he tells you to do." Brad pulled his knees up to his chin and muttered, "This is a hell of a way to run the mission." "No," said Little John, looking almost amused. "It's the human way. The way of the primate apes." Brad stewed inwardly as the sun set and the darkness enveloped the woods. His shelter wasn't big enough to pace in, so he pulled on his biosuit, then pushed out through the airlock seal and walked through the trees for the better part of an hour. He heard strange animal cries in the darkness and caught glimpses of a large bird gliding almost silently between the trees. He trudged up to the crest of the rise and looked down at the village. All the buildings were dark, not a single light showing anywhere. Then he realized that the hollow was bathed in a faint, eerie reddish glow. Looking up, he saw the crescent of Beta glowering down. "It's getting closer," he knew. Finally, he went back to his tubular shelter, crawled inside, and stripped off his suit. Sitting on the bedroll in nothing but his skivvies, he called to MC. "What time is it aboard the ship?" The computer's smooth voice instantly replied, 21:53. Felicia might be asleep already, he thought, but he told MC to buzz her personal channel anyway. His communicator screen glowed to life, and Felicia's warm-eyed face smiled at him. "I thought you would call," she said. "Woman's intuition?" Brad asked with a smile. "No, I heard about the meeting with the department heads." He rehashed the meeting with her, and Little John's claim that Kossoff felt that Brad was competing against him. Felicia listened patiently, then asked, "So what do you intend to do?" "I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Walk right down into the village tomorrow morning and say hello."
"Would that be wise?"
"It'd be better than sitting here doing nothing."
"So do it," she said.
Brad shook his head slowly. "But if I frighten them or anger them or screw up the contact in any way, the mission would be totally loused up, and it would all be my fault."
Felicia said, "It's all your responsibility, one way or another."
"My responsibility," Brad echoed. "Not Kossoff's damned committees.
It's a shame the gamins don't discover you on their own. Don't they ever leave their village?"
"They go to work in their fields, on the other side of the hollow from where I am. They forage for small game out at the edge of the hollow."
Felicia's expression turned thoughtful. "Too bad they don't come up to where you are and discover you on their own."
For several moments, Brad fell silent, thoughts whirling in his head. At last he said, "Maybe I could arrange that.
You think so?"
"It's worth a try." Temptation. Brad slept dreamlessly after his talk with Felicia, even though he realized he hadn't asked her how she was doing or what she was doing in his absence. He awoke as morning sunlight brightened the curved surface of his tent. Sitting up, he called MC and asked for a review of the animals that the gamins caught and ate. By mid-morning, Brad was outside the shelter in his biosuit, cheerfully building a primitive trap from branches and twigs, humming to himself.
His work was clumsy at first, especially with his hands encased in the suit's thin, slightly slippery gloves. But within a couple of hours, with MC's help, he had built a barred little box with a hinged door that could snap shut and lock. Then he reached up and pulled a bright-colored fruit from one of the sinuous trees. "It looks ripe," he said to himself. "We'll see." "What are you doing?" the voice of a controller demanded. Startled by the intrusion, Brad replied, "An experiment," and quickly returned his attention to his work. "That's not on the mission protocol." "Yes, it is. We're supposed to study the eating habits of the local fauna." The controller did what bureaucrats usually do when faced with a contradiction. He bucked the question to the next highest level of authority. "I just hope it doesn't get to Kossoff," Brad thought. With MC guiding him, Brad found tiny paw prints around the edges of the bushes at the base of one of the big, sky-reaching trees. He placed his lopsided little trap beneath the bush's leaves and backed away, then hunkered down on his stomach to watch and wait. And wait. And wait. "They're not coming," he muttered to MC. "Hunting requires patience," the computer replied. "The animals you seek are wary. After all, it's their lives that are at stake." Brad nodded inside his helmet. "Patience," he whispered. He was drifting off to sleep when he was startled by a screeching, snarling noise. His eyes flashing wide, Brad saw that a little furball was caught inside his rickety trap, desperately struggling to get out. Grinning at his success, Brad got to his feet and walked to the trap. The animal was making it shake and rattle with his exertions. It seemed to be half fur, half teeth, and either terrified or furious, perhaps some of both. Its eyes were wide and glaring. It had six little legs, Brad saw, and the fruit he had laid inside the trap for bait had been half gnawed away. "You had your meal before you realized you couldn't get out," he said to the trapped critter. Brad's plan was to go down to the edge of the village that night and lay the dead beast where the natives would be certain to find it. Curiosity would drive them to wonder how it got there, and that would impel them to follow the trail of his boot prints and find him. Contact. But that brought up a problem. He had to kill the animal. Brad stared down at the little beast. It had quieted down, probably exhausted from its struggles. It crouched inside the trap, panting and staring at him. He knew that the equipment in his pack included a laser pistol with enough power to instantly, painlessly kill a human being, let alone an undersized ferret. He also knew he couldn't do it. Well, he thought, I'll leave a live gift in the village. Tonight. He picked up the wooden cage. The animal snarled and nipped at Brad's fingers, making him drop the little coop. Its door popped open, and the furball scooted away, chattering furiously. Holding his hand close to his helmet, Brad saw that the critter's teeth had not penetrated the fabric of his glove. He didn't feel any pain, except to his ego. "Mighty hunter," Brad said to himself. Undeterred, he picked up the empty cage and started all over again. By nightfall, Brad had collected three squeaky, chittering little rodents in three lopsided, flimsy traps. He had added primitive straps made from vines so that he could carry them without getting his fingers nipped. As he gently laid his handiwork outside his shelter, he saw that all three animals had curled up and gone to sleep. Good, he thought. The quieter, the better. Using the night vision optics in his helmet, he carefully carried his catches to the crest of the ridge and looked down at the village. Only one light was showing, in the building he thought of as the longhouse.